Hey, we are in Genesis chapter 37 this morning. So I don't know if I've told this story or not. One of the fears you have when you have been teaching as long as I have is that you recycle illustrations. So I don't know if I've told this story before or not, but there was my mom grew up in Florida, lived in Hialeah, and that's where my dad actually met her. He was in the military down there at the Homestead Air Force Base, and so he'd drive up to meet her. So naturally, when I grew up, since Dad had transplanted Mom into Green Bay, Wisconsin from Florida, we would still go down to Florida to see Grandma. And I don't know the timing of that. I think I asked my mom a few years ago, because it seemed like we would go every 4 or 5 years. But she said, no, we would go like every other year or so. I don't know, the truth is in there somewhere. So we would go down and spend a few weeks down there. Usually it would be, because it was back before there was an interstate completely down to Florida, so it would take us 3 days to get down there. We'd stay 2 weeks and we'd drive then 3 days back. So we were usually gone for at least 2 or 3 weeks. And so we stayed at Grandma's house. And I remember this one particular night, some of us were sitting around in the living room of her small house. And some of my siblings, I think it was my younger brother and my younger sister, were in the bedroom. And you could hear something going on. It was real loud and they were rambunctious or something. So my dad said, go check on your brother and sister. So I go into the bedroom and they were throwing a pillow back and forth. And so as I walked into the bedroom and I saw that, I was about ready to say, stop throwing the pillow. And one of them threw the pillow and it hit the light fixture. And I don't know if your homes have them or not. Mine does, but we have a light fixture right in the middle of the bedroom up in the wall. Well, you screw on light fixture, it's all glass. Well, it hit that and that came down, hit the floor and just exploded. Glass everywhere. Well, obviously, it's heard in the or in the living room, so I'm in there. I wasn't involved with it, but my dad comes in, and he's now angry and upset, and so the next thing I know, all three of us are out in the living room being disciplined for something that we did. Now, one of my dad's favorite modes of discipline was to have us kneel against the wall. You would get down on your knees on the hard floor, and you'd put your nose about an inch from the wall, and you'd have to just sit there like that. And you can imagine sitting like that for a period of time gets a little bit uncomfortable, and you know. But that was one of the ways that he would discipline us, right? Well, the plan was you will stay there until you apologize to Grandma. I'm like, well, I didn't do anything. I tried to explain that to Dad. I didn't do anything. You sent me in there. But he just wasn't going to have any of it. We were all somehow involved. And so I'm like, this really isn't fair. So do you think I was going to apologize for something that I didn't do? No, I was going to plead my case. So I kept saying, I didn't do anything. Well, next thing I know, I'm the only one there on my knees. My brother and sister said, oh, we're sorry. And Dad's like, good, fine, be on. But nope. So I stayed there and mind, no, I'm going to do it, you know. Because I was mad because I had nothing to do with it. I was falsely accused and now I was being penalized for something I didn't do. Now, I don't remember how that all played out. I do remember at some point, I think my dad finally just gave up because I certainly wasn't going to give up. And at some point, I think he just said, go to bed! So I did. But quite a few years later, I pulled my dad aside and I said, this still bugs me. Remember this episode, you know? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, you sent me in there. I wasn't in there for more than 10 seconds. How could you think that I was involved? And my dad was always gracious and loving. And he's kind of like, well, yeah, I probably didn't handle that right, you know, whatever. But it's a little bit too late, you know? Well, we have a story today. You've heard the idiom that no good deed goes unpunished. So my good deed was to do what I was told, and it went punished, right? No good deed goes unpunished. In some respects, this idiom, I think, reflects what we're going to see today in our passage with Joseph, because Joseph really faces consequences for something that he really shouldn't have. We're going to look at his story today. I'm going to break it down. We're from chapter 37, verses 12 through 36. Again, I'm going to break it down into three pieces. We're going to first see Joseph's obedience in following his father's instructions to check on the welfare of his brothers and his father's flocks. But then we're going to see this good deed rewarded, and that's some sarcasm, by his brothers depravity and wicked behavior. But then ultimately, the third thing, in the end, we're going to see God's sovereignty and that he's still in control even in that circumstance. So let's take a look at these first five or six verses or so. Chapter 37, Joseph's obedience. Chapter 37, look at verses 12 through 17 with me. It says, "Then his brothers went to pasture their flocks in Shechem." I'm going to start my timer here so I remember. "Then his brothers went to pasture their flock, father's flocks in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come and I will send you to them.' And he said to him, 'I will go.' Then he said to him, 'Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock and bring word back to me.' So he sent him from the valley of Hebron and he came to Shechem. A man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, 'What are you looking for?' He said, 'I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock.' And the man said, 'They have moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go on to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan." Now what stands out to me in these verses here is the way that Joseph obeyed his father. I'm going to say it this way. He was both willing and he was diligent in his obedience when it came to what his father had asked. So let's look first at his willingness here. Verse 12 says that Joseph's brothers were pasturing the flocks in a place called Shechem. That was about 60 miles north of where he was currently with his father, Jacob. So 60 miles. And Jacob was apparently concerned about the welfare of his brother, of his sons, and the flocks. We talked about this a little bit last week. Now, the journey to Shechem would not have been an easy one. You have to remember a few things here. The first is that Joseph was only 17 years of age. That's what the Bible tells us. So he's a son. Now, 17 back then was probably older than 17 today. I think we would probably agree with that. But still, nonetheless, he's still a youth. He's still 17. It would have taken him at least 4 days. And this journey would have taken him through the wilderness where there were no towns or villages that we know of along the route. Not any bigger cities that we can think of. So it would have taken him probably 4 days or so to wander through the wilderness. Bandits and other dangers were pretty common in the days of Joseph. And so traveling alone by yourself through the wilderness like this was often a dangerous thing. You not only had dangers from bandits, but also some wild animals. Other things like having to carry proper amount of water, etc., food with you. So this was not just some easy trip like we would think of today. Let's go 60 miles. I mean, I can do 60 miles in my car in an hour. With the air conditioning on, stopping, finding bathrooms if I needed, or picking up lunch on the way. It wasn't the same way in this day. Now to add another challenge, shepherds and flocks usually had to move around. So when Joseph was told by his father, they're in Shechem, that's where they were supposed to be. But they would likely move around. And we find that out with Joseph when he got there. His brothers weren't there. And so he would be setting out with the idea that I'm going to Shechem, but I don't really know where to look. I don't even know if they're still going to be in Shechem or not. But I love Joseph's response. He didn't go begrudgingly. He went willingly. When his father asks him to go, look at verse 13. Verse 13, he says, "I will go." It's that simple. What I like about that is it kind of reminds me, you remember the story of Isaiah standing before the Lord's throne? He's like, "I've become undone." Well, the Lord says to him, "Whom shall I send and whom will go for us?" And do you remember what Isaiah's response was? Here I am. Those were his words. Here I am. Send me. There's a sense of eagerness there. Not just willingness to be involved. And I look at Joseph here, and the fact that it doesn't just say, "and so he went." It has his words here, and he says, "I'll go." So we see this willingness to obey his father here. Now, there wasn't just a willingness on Joseph's part. There was also a diligence to it. He didn't approach the task half-heartedly. But he was actually pretty diligent in accomplishing what his father set out for him, or what his father had told him to do. When he arrives in Shechem, it says here that his brothers weren't there. He comes across this man, and the man sees him just sort of wandering through the fields, and he's wandering because he can't find his brothers. They were supposed to be in Shechem, but they weren't in Shechem. So he's wandering around looking for him, and he sees this man, and he's like, well, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm looking for my brothers. And the old man says, well, you know, I heard them talking about going to Dotham. Well, see, Dotham is another 10 miles further north. A good part of a day's journey. But instead of him going, well, did my best. I've been on the road for 4 days. I got at least another 4 days back. I'm just going back home to see Dad. I'm going to tell him. I don't know where they are. They're probably fine. But what does he do? All right. Continues on. Walks the extra 10 miles. We find out a little bit here. He makes it to Dotham. He finds his brothers. So what we see, I believe, in Joseph here is that he demonstrated two important traits when it comes to obedience. One is a willingness to obey, and the second is a diligence in that obedience. The two really, from a biblical standpoint, go hand in hand. It's one thing to be willing and to do it half-heartedly or begrudgingly. I did what I was told. It's another thing to do it willingly and to do it diligently, to see that it's accomplished, to see that you do exactly what it is that's being asked of you to do. You see, God's desire is that we obey willingly, not reluctantly or begrudgingly, and he asks us to do it diligently. He doesn't want our obedience to be the result of some compulsion or fear. It's not like Jacob says, come on, Jacob or Joseph, I need you to go. Really, Dad? Oh, man, that's 60 miles. That's, you know, I've got, what about my friends? I got some things to do, you know? Plus, it's hot. It's a long journey. You know, Dad, it's dangerous too. You know, what happens if something happens to me? You don't get that impression at all from him here that instead he says, I'll go. When God delivered the law to Israel, he knew how difficult it would be. But he reminded them that what he was really seeking after was faithful obedience based on a love for him. He wanted them to obey the law out of their love, not out of compulsion. He wanted a willingness, but he also expected a form of diligence. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 30. I love this because we oftentimes forget, you know, God gave the law to them, which that would have been overwhelming. How many commands are in the Old Testament law, Matt? Do you remember?
613.
Yeah. That's a lot. And can you imagine Moses reading these things to the Israelites? Their eyes are glossing over, thinking, how in the world are we going to do this? It's a pretty high bar. And so God kind of encourages them. Deuteronomy chapter 30, jump down to verse 11. For this commandment, meaning the law, which I command you today, it isn't too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. Now, if I were an Israelite, I think I'd fare to disagree, Lord. 613? What do you mean it's not too difficult? What do you mean it's not out of reach? Verse 12. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will go up to heaven for us to get it for us and make us hear that we may observe it? Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross the sea for us to get it, for us to make it and hear it, that we may observe it? He says, the word is very near to you, in your mouth and in your what, heart, that you may observe it. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity and death and adversity, that in the command, that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that the Lord your God may bless you in the land where you will entirely possess it. But if your heart turns away, and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I will declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death and blessings and curse. So choose in order that you may live, you and your descendants. Now look at this. This whole thing God was driving towards. By loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, and by holding fast to him, for this is your life and your length of days, and that you may live in the land in which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and give them. Later on, he says, it's all summarized up in loving the Lord your heart with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. In other words, God wasn't asking the Hebrews there, okay, here are 613 commandments, create a checklist, just start checking them off begrudgingly. He's like, look, put it in your heart. Love me from your heart. Obey me from your heart. Love me with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. I believe that's what motivated Joseph. Loved his father. Was willing to obey. Was diligent when he did it. And that's the other part of this, is that God desires that we be diligent in our obedience. I want you to turn to Psalm 119 and look at how David refers to doing what God wants. He describes obedience in Psalm chapter 119. Verses 57 through 64. He says, the Lord is my portion. I have promised to keep your words. That's a diligence right there. I promised to keep your words. I sought your favor with my heart. Be gracious to me according to your word. I consider my ways and turned my feet to your testimonies. I hastened and did not delay to keep your commandments. The cords of the wicked have encircled me. But I have not forsaken your law. At midnight I shall rise to give thanks to you because of your righteous ordinances. I am a companion for all those who fear you and those who keep your precepts. The earth is full of your loving kindness, O Lord. Teach me your statutes. There was a diligence. Now we know David failed at times. He wasn't perfect in his obedience, but he was diligent. That's why the Lord calls him a man after his own heart. David wasn't just willing to obey, but he was diligent to obey. I shared before that my dad was given the nickname Speedy Jack by his coworkers. My dad was a perfectionist. I always thought that, you know, they called him Speedy Jack because he was so darn slow with everything he did. So one day, I worked at the same paper factory my dad did, and I worked a graveyard shift, and one particular night, my uncle also worked at the same paper factory. And so one particular night, I was driving the forklift through the basement level of the factory and was driving through this section, and there were a bunch of lockers there and a bathroom and stuff. And I happened to be driving through there, and I saw my uncle, which was unusual because he usually worked day shift, but he happened to be there at night. So I stopped my forklift, and hey, Uncle Glenn, he kind of saw me, and he came over, and he goes, hey, you realize this is the area your dad works, which I didn't know. I had never been there. I didn't know where my dad worked. I just knew he was a millwright all over the mill. And I said, no, I didn't realize that. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, his locker is right over there. And I'm like, well, that's kind of cool, you know. And he's like, you know, they call your dad Speedy Jack. And I went, well, we've known that for years, you know. Even aunts and uncles call him that. I said, yeah, so darn slow. And he looked at me kind of funny. He goes, huh. He goes, they don't call him Speedy Jack because he's slow. I'm like, well, of course they do. Dad's even talking about it. He goes, yeah, but there's a bigger issue to that. He goes, your dad's not just slow. It's not like your dad can't do anything fast. He's like, they call him that because he takes his time doing things so that he can do them right. I thought, well, that's an interesting twist on it. And so he began to tell me a story about how he's like, you know, your dad's the guy they call in when somebody else screws up. He said, you know all those late night calls you get and the weekend calls that your dad says don't answer the phone because it's work calling to bring him in? It's because they always call your dad because when somebody screws up, it's because it wasn't done right. And they know if they call your dad, he's going to do it right. But we also know it's going to take your dad some time because he's going to make sure that it's done right. You see, for my dad to do something, he didn't want to just be willing to do it. He wanted to do it right. He was diligent about making sure that it was done the way that it was supposed to be done. And I think the first thing we see with Joseph here, even though it's not absolutely clear, it's not spelled out directly, what we do see in him is that when his father asks him to obey, he says, send me, I'll go. And then when he does it, he makes sure that he completes the task. He's diligent about it. He doesn't give up halfway. He doesn't just say, well, he went off somewhere else, Dad. Sorry, get somebody else. He's diligent about the way that he does it. So we see, again, two principles here of obedience. A willingness, but also a diligence. Do it right. And that's really essentially what God commanded the Israelites. He didn't want them just to jump through the hoops and check off the items. He wanted them to do it right. Be diligent to obey him by loving him with their heart, soul, mind, and strength. Same thing, again, David describes in Psalm 119. Now you would think that Joseph would be rewarded for this. You know, because good behavior, diligence, and obedience to God should be rewarded, right? Unfortunately, because of his brother's depravity. It didn't quite go so well for Joseph. So we're going to look next year at his brother's depravity, verses 18 through 35. But we saw at the beginning of chapter 27 that Joseph's brothers ultimately hated him. And they hated him because he was favored by his father. They couldn't stand that tunic that his dad made for him. But they also hated him because of what God had revealed to Joseph and to them through him. They hated the content of what the dreams represented, that Joseph would rule over them someday. So they hated the content, the thought of that, but they also hated the fact that he was willing to share it with them, because they also hated his words. Now, what we see here is that that trend actually continued and even got worse. I would describe the behavior we're going to see here next as nothing short of pure wickedness and depravity. Let's take a look at what happens. The brothers, I'm going to highlight three acts of depravity or wickedness here in their plot. The first one is their plot to kill Joseph. Look at verses 18 through 24. So when Joseph spends all this time traveling, searching out his brothers to try to make sure that they're okay, make sure the flocks are okay, he's on a good mission for his father, instead of saying, "Oh, look, it's Joseph. You can report back to Dad, we're okay. Come here, sit down with us, have a meal, we'll get you ready for the trip to go back. But tell Dad everything's all right." Instead, what happens? When they saw him from a distance, he wasn't even there yet. Before he even came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. He hasn't even shown up yet. But they're already, "We've got to kill this guy." They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer." That tells you a little bit too, right? They're still upset about his dreams. "Now, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we'll say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of the hands and said, "Let's not take his life." Reuben further said to him, "Shed no blood. Instead, throw him into this pit that's in the wilderness, but don't lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So basically Reuben steps in here and says, "Hey, don't do this. Let's just throw him into this pit instead." And then he was hoping to come back later and rescue him without his brothers knowing. So Reuben is trying to be the good big brother here. Okay. Instead of just standing up to him though and saying, I'm a little afraid of that. So, "Well, let's throw him into this pit. He's going to come up with some kind of trickery. So throw him into this pit in the wilderness, but don't lay hands on him that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the varied-colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and they threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. So even before Joseph came close to them, they plot to kill him. Initially, their plan to murder him was what was on their thoughts. They basically just wanted to kill him and then toss him into a pit and then argue, "Well, a beast came and got him, Dad." But had it not been for Reuben, they probably would have done that. But he kind of intervenes, we see here. So they basically strip him of his robe. They toss him into this pit. It appears that they simply want him to now die from starvation and lack of water. Seems to be the point. Toss him into the pit. "We didn't kill him, and he died in the pit." You see where their motivation is here. Look back at verses 19 and 20. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him." But then, look at this. "Then let us see what will become of his dreams." So in some respects, they killed him out of hatred, but two, because they didn't want to see his dreams come true. That's a pretty wicked act, isn't it? It's pure depravity. Not just the thought of murder, but this is their own brother. Their second act of depravity was selling Joseph into slavery here. Look at verses 25 through 28. "Then they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gums and balm and myrrh and on their way to bring them down to Egypt." You know what I find stark about this? Did you catch what's kind of going on here? There's some wordplay, I think. Their plan was to toss him into a pit and then tell their dad, oh, he was eaten by a wild beast. But then after doing what they did and tossing him into a pit, what do they actually do? They sit down to eat. And I'm going to say much like wild beasts. I think there's some intentional wordplay there. So they sit down to just eat a meal together. No big deal. The brother's off dying in a pit somewhere. No heart, no compassion. Again, the wordplay there is a little bit telling. And along come these Ishmaelites. They're just traveling through Dothan, probably up towards the Mediterranean Sea to deliver their goods. We talked about this when we were studying some of the gifts of the wise men. This would have been one of those caravans that trafficked those herbs and things like frankincense and myrrh. And so they happen to wander by. So Judah gets this idea, verse 30 or 26. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood?" You catch that word he used? Some of your translations may say, "What gain?" So he's looking at it from the perspective of not, "Boy, this is a bad idea. We probably shouldn't have done this to our brother." He looks at it and goes, "Well, wait a minute. Why should we let him die? How does that benefit us? What profit is there in that for us? There's an opportunity here, boys, to make some money." He's looking at these travelers thinking, "We could sell him as a slave. So why let him die when we can profit? Come," verse 30 or 27, "let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he's our brother, he's our own flesh." Apparently, it's much better to sell your brother into slavery than it is to kill him, especially when you can make a buck or two off it. Somehow that's now morally acceptable. End of verse 27, "and his brothers listened to him." Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. That's the price of a slave in that day. 20 shekels of silver. It's really not a huge sum of money. It's not like they were set for life now. A few coins. But hey, at least they made a profit, right? At least there's something to gain for them. And it says, "Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt." The third act of depravity was how they then treated their father Jacob. It's not enough that they plotted to murder him and threw him in a pit. It's not enough that they threw him into that they sold him to Midianite traders as a slave. But their act of depravity now even extends to deceiving their father Jacob and lying to him. Look at verses 29 through 35. "Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments. He returned to his fathers, and he said, 'The boy is not here. As for me, where am I to go?'" Or he returned to his brothers, then said, "'The boy is not here. As for me, where am I to go?'" Now this is interesting too. So his plan, Reuben's plan, didn't work out the way that he expected. He thought he was saving Joseph by having him thrown into this pit. But he went back. Joseph's not there. Something happened. But even his words in verse 30, he seems to be thinking of himself, not his brother Joseph. "The boy's not here. As for me, where am I going to go now? What am I going to do?" I think there's an element of, he's the firstborn son. He's responsible. How is he going to explain this to his father, Jacob? He's concerned about himself. So they took Joseph's tunic. He's a part of this. It's not just the brothers. He's now a part of this. He's going to cover his butt. There's another idiom I won't use for that, but he's going to cover his butt. They took his tunic. They slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in blood. They sent the vari-colored tunic and brought it to the father and said, "We found this. Please examine it and see whether it's your son's tunic or not." They knew it was it. They knew. Is this Joseph's tunic, Dad? Look, it's covered. We found it. It's covered in blood. Is this his tunic? So Jacob examined it. Verse 33 says, "It's my son's tunic." A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins, and he mourned for his son for days. And this is the kicker here. Verse 35, then all his sons, the ones who were responsible for doing what they did, they and all his daughters arose to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted, and he said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning, meaning I'll die for my son. So his father wept for him. So the very people that just treated Joseph this way, now have not only deceived their father, but then they come in to comfort him in the deception. Make it sound like they're there to support him. And talk about the depravity here. The wickedness. That's the only way to describe this. I remember Pastor Krenz one time. Somebody in the church had committed adultery. And some of the elders had been referring to it at an elder meeting as an affair. And so when I met with Pastor Krenz, I'm sorry, it was actually at the elder meeting. He spoke up and said, wait a minute, gentlemen. What comes to mind when you think of an affair? It's fun. It's cool. It's enjoyable. It's an affair. You know, there was a TV show back in the day called A Family Affair. It's all about the activities of a family, you know? And he's like, this is not an affair. He said, this is wickedness. Let's call it what it is. The Bible calls it adultery. It's wickedness. And that's exactly what we see here. And Joseph paid the price. So what's our takeaway? I think what we have here is an example of the righteous suffering at the hands of the wicked. Joseph the righteous suffering at the hands of the wickedness of his brothers. That's a reality in our world. There's a theme we see throughout the Bible, beginning all the way back in Genesis 4, when wicked Cain murdered righteous Abel. That's where it all started. Wicked Cain murdered righteous Abel. He's called that in the Scriptures. He brought a proper sacrifice to the Lord. Cain didn't like it, because his sacrifice wasn't pleasing to the Lord. So what does he do? The same thing Joseph's brothers do. They murder the righteous. Or they, in this case, sell them into slavery. This is something that's continued throughout history. It's a theme that's played out all the way from the New Testament all the way through today, where the righteous are mistreated, martyred, killed, murdered, locked up, thrown away. I was reading something the other day about, I think it's Nigeria now, considered to be probably, when you rank countries in terms of Christian persecution, I believe it's Nigeria now is at least top 10. Somebody ranked it the number one. Literally, Christians in their homes in Nigeria literally are being slaughtered on a daily basis. They're hated by the unrighteous, by the wicked. It's a theme that's tied directly to our salvation, because the greatest example of this is Christ, is it not? The most righteous man in history, persecuted, mistreated, ultimately crucified on a cross. John chapter 15. John chapter 15, verse 18. You're all familiar with this. John chapter 15, verse 18. If the world hates you, I think that's probably better translated as since the world hates you. You know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you, would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but because I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you. A slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours too. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know the one who sent me. So Jesus warned us about this, that the righteous will be persecuted simply for being righteous by the wicked. Now, obviously, the good news is that in the end, our suffering is rewarded. God will judge both the righteous and the wicked. The wicked will pay the price for their treatment of the righteous and their treatment of Christ. Sometimes it doesn't feel like much of a consolation now, does it? We are somewhat protected from this, and I don't mean that in a literal sense because we still face things here, but obviously there are brothers and sisters in Christ all over the world that are suffering greatly, mistreated, much like Joseph, for faithfully following Jesus Christ. We're somewhat sheltered from that because we still live in a nation that still has somewhat of a residual slime on it of sorts. But the reality is, the righteous are going to suffer at the hands of the wicked. And Joseph certainly did. And that's something we're going to see throughout Joseph's story, is there's going to be some other examples where he suffers just for doing the right thing. It's not fair. It's unjust. But the one thing we see is that the Lord always sees it. The Lord is always at work. In fact, that's what happens next. Because next, what we see, and it's one verse here, we see God's sovereignty through all of this. Joseph wasn't lost in all of this. It wasn't that the Lord said, I'm not going to reward you for your obedience and your diligence and your willingness to obey. I'm not going to forget about you because of what your brothers did to you. Look at what the last verse says, chapter 37, verse 36. And we have a tendency sometimes to just glance over phrases like this or words like this, but it says, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. Now, if we didn't know the rest of the story, we'd say, so what? He's now a slave. We would probably look at this as a bad thing. Well, yeah, he actually now is the slave of an Egyptian guy who works for the Pharaoh. None of us would look at that as a positive thing. That's sort of the end of the story, right? That, yep, he's sold into slavery and now he's a slave of somebody. But because we know the rest of the story, what we realize with this is a very specific work of God here, because what we're going to find, and we can rehash this as we go through some of these things, that actually what happens here is that this is all part of God's sovereign plan. God's plan, as he revealed through Joseph's dream, was that Joseph would one day rise to a position of prominence and rule, not only over his family, we learn that he will rule over almost all of Egypt. His brothers tried to circumvent that. Remember what they said? Let's see what comes of his dreams now. So they tried to circumvent that. But the fact that God placed him into Potiphar's house, God was still working his plan. In spite of their wicked plans, God was in control of Joseph's destiny. And so what does he do? He puts him into Potiphar's house. And what we're going to learn about that is, he's in Potiphar's house and he impresses Potiphar. God makes him succeed in Potiphar's house. And everything he does, he succeeds in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar looks at him and says, wow, and makes him supervisor over all of his estate. The only thing that's off limits is his wife. Doesn't care. Just doesn't even check his, I think, well, and his food, if I remember right. He's going to check his food. His pharaohs and others would be poisoned through food, right? But for the most part, he rises up to this high position. Now what we find is that all comes crashing down. But that's even still part of God's plan. But it was part of God's plan, and it is important in the story, because even this time with Potiphar leads to his time with Pharaoh. And they're all connected. And so this statement in verse 36, that the Midianites sold him into the Pharaoh's officer, Potiphar, made him a slave, is all part of God's sovereign plan for Joseph. He's not forgotten. God was totally in control. Look at verses 4 and 8 out of chapter 45. Just flip over to chapter 45. Chapter 45, verses 4 through 8. This is after his brothers finally come there and meet him years later. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." And they came closer, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. But look at this. For God sent me before you to prepare or to preserve life." He says, you may have sold me, but God was ultimately the one that was in control of that. God was sending me. For the famine has been in these lands 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither growing or plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all his household and a ruler over all of the land of Egypt. 3 times in this passage, Joseph said, God sent, God sent, God sent. You go back to chapter 37:46. They sold him to the Midianites, and they then sold him to Potiphar. But it was God who sent him. God was in control of verse 36. Joseph said, it was God who sent me here. Here meaning what? Here to Egypt. So what his brothers did, God was in control of. It wasn't them, it was God. I'll say it this way. They were merely a tool. We don't like to think that way sometimes, but they were merely a tool. God used them to accomplish his purpose and his plan for Joseph, which ultimately had to do with rescuing and saving them, which is ironic in and of itself. They tried to kill him, but Joseph said, yeah, but you see, God sent me on to save you. How ironic is that? A little bit later on, you all know this phrase, Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, Joseph says, what you meant for evil, God meant for what? For good. You can't thwart God. So what's our takeaway with that? Well, we know in our heads that God is sovereign, but it doesn't always feel that way, especially when we're suffering and facing injustice. We don't always know what was in Joseph's thinking here. The Bible presents him, though, as being faithful, obedient. It never shows him discouraged. Sometimes the scripture likes to present the best side of someone, and we don't always see all the negative stuff. Sometimes we do. So we don't really know what was going through Joseph's head here. Was there a moment where he might have been discouraged? Maybe. We're going to see some other examples where things don't go the way they're supposed to go. Even in one instance, they don't go the way Joseph hoped and planned it would go. But yet, he never seems to lose hope. He always seems to recognize that God is involved somehow. Which I think helps us understand that the reason Joseph may have been like that is because he believed that God was who he was. He was sovereign and would accomplish what he set out to accomplish. That's why he so confidently could say, it was God who sent me here. Guys, you don't understand. Yeah, you screwed up. You were pretty miserable. You were depraved and wicked. But guess what? God intended it for my good. And your good. Job chapter 42, verse 2 says, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. That's pretty good from a man who suffered miserably, unjustly, unrighteously. The Lord told Isaiah chapter 14, verse 27, for the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? As for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? Who can change it? Joseph's brothers couldn't. They couldn't stop the dream from happening. Coming true. Why? Because God's hand. Isaiah chapter 46, verse 10. My purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Something Dustin had shared with me from a young man that he's been discipling has to do with sort of the viewpoints on end time eschatology, fulfillment, and other things. And one of the things that keeps coming to mind as I've been thinking through some of it was Many of us believe that God will fulfill the promises to Israel, not because of Israel, but because of God. God routinely says throughout the Old Testament that he will fulfill his promises literally to Israel, not because of Israel, but because of himself and his own glory. It says something about him, and it has something to say about his sovereignty. And so partly what's at stake here is while Joseph's brothers are trying to prevent the dream from being fulfilled, God's saying, my sovereignty is at stake here. This will be accomplished because I will accomplish it. It says something about me. And so even the simple statement in verse 36, he ends up in Potiphar's house. We'd be remiss if we didn't catch the nuance there that's God working. God put him in Potiphar's house. This was not a mistake. That's our hope as Christians. It's not just some kind of wishful thinking. When we are going through difficult times, if we're facing injustice like Joseph, if we have situations at work or in our neighborhood or our family or friends where we're being mistreated, we can think of some examples here with Dr. Long and that their family were mistreated, you know, the things that are going on. Deidre, you've got stuff at work that just doesn't seem right. Okay? Our hope is in the sovereignty of God that it'll work out exactly as God wants it to work out. He hasn't lost control. We can forget that sometimes because we're in the midst of it. Joseph could have forgotten that. I don't think he did. But that's what we're tempted in. I know I do. I've shared examples from work before where, you know, I had to deal with issues with my boss and some other things, and God just took care of all of that. But I had to tell myself at that time, I had to make a decision. Okay, I struggled. I was being mistreated. I didn't think it was being fair. I was being accused of things that I wasn't doing. They were wrong. But I had to sweat through that and think, how am I going to handle this? And I had to rest on God's sovereignty. God's going to take care of this. And that's what we see here. I want to do one last thing with this, though. One of the things that I haven't stressed enough of, but we need to keep in mind, part of what I focus on here is the practical stuff. What does this mean for us? But something else that I'm going to try to make sure I remind us of is that when we look at the story of Joseph, we also have to look at it from the perspective of him being a type of Christ. Now, you've heard me use that. It's a fancy theological word, type, T-Y-P-E. It basically means an example. So David was a type of Jesus. Things about David that represent Christ. He reflects Christ. And it's the Old Testament's way of speaking forward about the Messiah and about Christ and about the gospel. Okay? Joseph is also a type of Christ. And so as we see Joseph, we also have to sort of see it reflecting Christ. And so one of the ways we do that with this passage today is he suffered unjustly. Just like Christ suffered unjustly for his righteousness. But I want to just point out a couple of things that I think you might find kind of cool. And these are going to be those little areas where there's a little bit of speculation, but enough to where we're like, huh, maybe there's something here. But I want you to think of some of the things we've seen already. We have Joseph being presented as the willing, diligent, obedient servant, which is what Christ said of himself in serving his father. We also have Joseph being presented as favored by his father, which we also see reflected in Christ. Here is my son in whom I am well pleased. We also see him hated by his brothers. Don't we see that reflected by Christ as well, being hated by his own family? On a more specific note, is there anything we can make of Joseph's robe? He was stripped of his robe in the same way that Christ was stripped of his garments, covered in blood. Is there some allusion there? I don't know, but it's interesting to think about. We have him, Joseph, thrown into a pit, left for dead. Is that not what they expected of Christ? Oftentimes in the Old Testament, pit is a reference to grave. And so is there some allusion there? Joseph being thrown into a pit, left for dead. Jesus being left into a grave, hoping that his dreams, I don't mean it that way literally, but rather what Jesus had prophesied They attempted to prevent it from happening. Put him in a grave, put guards around it. He's not going to raise from the dead. His dreams are not going to be fulfilled, meaning his visions of things that he predicted. What about Joseph being sold for the price of a slave? Jesus was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, which was a price of a slave in those days. So we see these interesting statements, these interesting allusions. They're all, I believe, and maybe some of them are a bit of a stretch, like his multicolored robe and the guy, I don't know. But there's enough here to show us that Joseph is a type of Christ. And so as we look at this, we ought to see that reflected. And we'll continue to see that. I may not be emphasizing that every week, but I want us to make sure we remember that. Because again, my focus is going to be on what can we learn from Joseph and apply it to our own faith. But we can't lose sight of the fact that he is a type, an example, a foreshadowing of Christ. That makes sense? So I'll try to make sure we keep that in our focus, but also focusing on the more practical.